It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And we are off and running with this Trump-tanic Titanic Tuesday, the 17th day of September 2019. This is the Horn. HeadOn.live is where you find us on the interweb tube. And that, of course, is also where you go for all your podcasting needs for the program, as well as chat platform. Jump right into the merry, wacky, zany multimedia real-time extravaganza that is the Horn chat room by picking out a screen name and a password. And getting a Laurel and Hardy greeting from the people already there. That would be Anatole and Jimmy and Kiazzi and Squeaky, all capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third stage guild navigator, has indeed folded space to become Man Cave. His powers are legendary. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude. Thank you to our subscribers for this here 17th day of the month. That would be Nancy and Gary, my buddy Gary, labor man in New Mexico. Nancy and Gary, thank you very kindly. A reminder, we need subscribers, and if you would like to be one, this would be a great time to be one, because Ralph's has a challenge on the table, good through the 20th of the month, in which Ralph's will, well, double your $10 subscription for up to five people, up to $50. So that's huge. And like I said, we need new subscribers. If you want to do it through PayPal, that's cool. If you want to do it through Patreon, that's cool too. So either way, you know, it would be great to have some new subscribers, especially based on that data that came to light last week. For every person who contributes to keep the Horn on the air, there are 100 who do not. Ponder that for a moment. We try to make this program free for anybody who wants it. And certainly, if people who can't afford it are more than welcome to it. This is not commercial radio. This is not some attempt to deliver you into the tender mercies of some advertiser who wants to sell you a vacuum cleaner that'll pick up a bowling ball or a steel building or patent nostrums or get you to buy gold at inflated prices. This is none of those things. This is about as non-capitalist as an effort can be, and still happen inside the United States. And for those, you know, for that $10 a month subscription, it's working out, like I've said before, to less than half the price of a pack of gum per day. And so if we could get some new subscribers, it would mean a lot, because there's a considerable amount of what is referred to shorthand as donor fatigue out there. So if you would consider running over to the contribute tab, it would be mighty helpful, because we're at minus $390. $390 to go to come even for this week. And if we finish fundraising this week, we're done for the month of September. But we're a long way from it right now. So that would be a big deal. $390. Sparky says, so tell us, Bob, how you get your numbers. By looking at the listenership. Brother Deacon Asa sorted that out. Because, you know, me and Cyphron. By the way, Brother Deacon Asa points out, hot on both pontoons aboard the USS Trump Tanic, heading towards that iceberg at flank speed, Captain Kincaid. Oh, yeah. And it will show it. We'll show it a thing or two. Nitwit Nero is in California, and the Trump regime took dead aim at California today, saying that they're going to take California's ability to regulate its own air quality away from it. Because, you know, the air is just too damn clean in California. What's LA without a blanket of smog? These evil pricks. Jesus. Darlene is already done to a tender turn this afternoon. Are you fucking kidding me? Ooh, are you kidding me? I know you got to be watching C-SPAN. Corey Lewandowski accidentally calling Ripig Biggs president, and I think he just called Swalwell President Swalwell. Am I hearing things? Man, there's so much Freudian going on here. It was a circus. And I understand why they called him. But he was never going to show up as a good faith witness. He was a hostile witness from jump. Including, but not limited to, going off on a Hillary rant early on. Yeah, no kidding, a Hillary rant.
Dedicated operation that succeeded in helping him capture the Republican nomination. My job was simple: provide Mr. Trump with my best advice, spend his money like it was my own, and give him the support he needed to win. I also set long-term objectives and managed day-to-day decisions. I had the privilege, and it was a privilege, of helping transform the Trump campaign from a dedicated but small makeshift organization to a historical and unprecedented political juggernaut. And I am proud to say Mr. Trump won 38 primaries and caucuses and received more votes than any candidate in the history of the Republican Party.
Notwithstanding a bunch of monkey business fake news, right?
All while being outspent most of the way. The historic campaign helped Mr. Trump secure the Republican nomination, ultimately the presidency of the United States. However...
Nah, that was the Electoral College and Russians. That's what got him the presidency. Because he still lost the popular vote, but we all know that, don't we?
Since Election Day, whether it was bad actors at the FBI and the intelligence community, or lies coming from members of the current House majority that there was evidence of collusion, the American people continue to be sold a false narrative with the purpose of undermining the legitimacy of the 2016 election results.
Man, that's so bellicose, you'd almost think that Brat Kavanaugh wrote it. Was there anything in there about beer? Is that you, Brat?
But no matter the size, campaigns are not always the most efficient organizations. And while you run in single congressional districts, just imagine what it's like to lead a national campaign that spans all 50 states of the union. During my time as campaign manager, there were competing interests for the candidate's time and a sea of ideas, some laudable, some sound.
Sea, cesspool, tomato, tomato.
A few not so much, many of which were dismissed out of hand, Others were passed on to staffers to be handled. I also received hundreds of thousands of emails, some days with as many as 1,000 emails.
Get the hockey puck. Here it comes.
And unlike Hillary Clinton, I don't think I ever deleted any of those. Many of them were responded to with either one-word answers or forwarded to other staffers for additional follow-up. But throughout it all, and to the best of my recollection, I don't ever recall having any conversations with foreign entities, let alone any who were offering to help to manipulate the outcome of an election. As I've said publicly many times, anyone who attempted to illegally impact the outcome of an election should spend the rest of their life in jail. And let me stress this fact. During the 2016 election cycle, Mr. Trump held no elected position. He was not a government official. Rather, the Obama-Biden administration and the intelligence community, overseen by James Clapper.
Suddenly, it's the Obama-Biden administration, you'll notice. This bullshit went on for a while. Probably, though, the most... I feel kind of... It doesn't feel right to refer to this as having entertaining aspects, but it did. Among other things, as Shorty in L.A. pointed out, Gerald Nadler interrupted Lewandowski to read him literally the Riot Act. Well, no, not the Riot Act, literally, but literally the inherent contempt power. Wow. And so, he had people like Doug Collins, who is Atne Ute Aitbre, if you one what I eme, trying to provide cover for him. But it was really it really was of no help when it came to Sheila Jackson Lee. These are instructive.
Today about your favorite football team. I'm not sure.
Patriots.
Patriots. So you're pretty happy right now, right?
Tom's a winner.
Again, the problem we have here is we don't follow procedure, because if it gets in the way of a good story, we don't like it around here.
Okay. Favorite football team. That was Doug Collins. Sort of providing evidence of what I just said about his lack of mental capacity.
Investigation when he asked you to deliver him a note about...
This, however, is him trying to be smart, Lewandowski, with Sheila Jackson Lee. It's a battle of wits to which he brought a whoopee cushion.
Investigation when he asked you to deliver him a note about that very investigation. Did the president tell you that?
What you've just read on the screen, Congresswoman.
You need to look at the screen.
There it is.
Yes or no? Read the screen.
You're welcome to read it, Congresswoman.
You're welcome to be stalling, and I'm not going to stall. You either answer the question yes or no.
Congressman, I'll take the same privileges that you've had other members.
Did the president tell you that nobody at the White House was supposed to even contact the Attorney General about the investigation? That you can answer yes or no.
I will not disclose any conversations I've had with the president, Congressman.
Again, you are obviously here to block any reasonable inquiry into the truth or not of this administration. The White House counsel, quote, shortly after Sessions announced his recusal, directed that Sessions should not be contacted about the special counsel investigation.
But, Corey Lewandowski's a sleazy little criminal, allegedly. And so there was no way that he could answer the question. He felt like he treated Representative Jackson Lee as if he felt she was getting kind of, you know, uppity. And given half a chance, I'll bet you, I'm sure as soon as the hearing was over, that word was probably burbling out of his mouth to anyone who would hear it, and we know what that word is. So, taken together, today was a hot mess. Doug Collins was equally ill-equipped all throughout the hearing. Representative Debbie McCarcel Powell got into it with Collins, and Collins flipped right the fuck out.
Protect him no longer. Mr. Chairman, on this 223rd Constitution Day, we could not be in a more important place in this Judiciary Committee, proving to the American people.
Now, this is Madeline Dean.
That their Constitution, our Constitution, is stronger than a president in search of corruption and cover-up. I yield back.
Gentlelady yields back. The gentlelady from Florida.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lewandowski, my colleagues have gone through some unbelievable acts by the president attempting to obstruct an investigation into his conduct and then to cover it up. That cover-up has extended to preventing witnesses from coming to talk to this committee without any lawful basis of doing so. Let me just be very clear. We are right now in the United States of America, and we have a president who is obstructing our congressional investigation into his misconduct. And we know why he's doing this. The president wants to prevent witnesses from testifying to Congress and the American people because he wants to hide his misconduct. We've heard the name Rick Dearborn a lot today, the former deputy chief of staff.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
On August...
The gentlelady will suspend. The gentleman will state his point of order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just ask without...
In other words, apparently that name was sufficient to put a barb in the soft pink and tender spot there of Doug Collins' hide. So he has to try to break up the flow.
Father, is the gentlelady accusing the president of a crime?
What did she say?
I can reword.
Yeah, she can reword. I'll be happy to withdraw.
I am not accusing anyone of anything. Can I continue? Can I reclaim my time, please?
Not if you continue in the vein you're continuing with the question saying
Mr.
that he
Collins,
committed a crime.
This is not a reality TV show.
Not
this
for you
is
either.
A serious Judiciary Committee hearing.
Then ask
we are
question.
Trying to investigate conduct by the president.
Gentlemen, has
may stated, I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Gentleman has stated his point of order. The gentlelady may continue with
Thank
her
you.
Time.
On August 26th, the committee served a subpoena on Rick Dearborn to appear here today. You testified that you gave Dearborn the message dictated to him by the president. We went over that message today. It asked the attorney general to direct the special counsel not to investigate the president. But that's not all. Mr. Dearborn was also Jeff Sessions' chief of staff during the Trump campaign. In that role, Dearborn coordinated meetings for candidate Trump and the Trump campaign. Meetings that were organized by Russian organizations. Dearborn himself communicated with Russian officials. But once again, the president is trying to prevent us from learning the truth about his conduct. Let's be honest here. Mr. Dearborn is not here today because the president is afraid of what he would tell us and the American people. The president directed him not to appear based on a fake claim of absolute immunity. And even though we can't hear from this important witness about the president's potential obstruction of justice, I will share some of the subjects that I would have asked Mr. Dearborn if he were here today. Mr. Lewandowski, we heard that the president directed you to deliver a message to the attorney general. You asked Dearborn to deliver the message dictated to you by the president, correct?
Can you remind me what page that's in the Mueller report?
Volume 2, page 92, right in the middle of the page.
Okay, thank you.
Right under point 2. Following his June meeting with the president.
I believe that's accurate. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. And you gave Dearborn that message and asked him to deliver it?
I believe that's accurate, yes.
Thank you. Well, what we know is that Dearborn did not deliver your secret message. In fact, he told the special counsel, quote, and you can see it on the screen, being asked to serve as a messenger to Sessions made Dearborn uncomfortable. It definitely raised an eyebrow. Dearborn recalled not wanting to ask where it came from or think further about doing anything with it. And as soon as the president learned that Dearborn knew and told the special counsel how bad it was, he's directed him now not to come in front of this committee to testify. So it's no wonder the president wants to prevent Dearborn from testifying, because we would be able to ask him why he wanted nothing further to do with the president's conduct, why he was so uncomfortable he didn't deliver that message. In fact, Dearborn, as an actual government employee, was familiar with the Presidential Records Act. He knew that any official business must be documented, but he did not keep the notes. The president doesn't want us to know why Dearborn didn't even want to keep that message. Dearborn also knew the White House policy that any messages to the Attorney General were supposed to go through the White House counsel. The president doesn't want us to ask Dearborn why it was so wrong for the president to call in his private enforcer instead of the White House counsel. So, again, let's make something very clear here today. Presidents of the United States cannot ignore congressional subpoenas. Richard Nixon learned this. His impeachment proceedings had an article of impeachment based on doing exactly that. No president can be allowed to violate his or her constitutional duties, nor can any president be allowed to obstruct a congressional investigation or hide crimes. We will not sit back and let this president continue to obstruct justice any longer. Let me remind everyone that in this country, no one is above the law. Thank you. I yield back my time.
I still move to take down her words.
Which words do you want taken down?
She will no longer allow this president to obstruct justice. She cannot do that.
I will rule that she can do that.
I will fill the ruling of the chair, then.
Fine. The ruling of the... We'll suspend the gentleman. We will suspend for a moment.
Yeah, because Doug Collins doesn't want said what the truth is, because, well, maggots are allergic to the truth. Truth and a maggot is like salt and a slug. Facts and a maggot are like salt and a slug. And this is, if for those of us who would like to see impeachment proceedings, guess what? This is what it's going to be like all the way through. No reason not to do it, but just sort of strap in when and if it does happen. Because the maggots are devoted and dedicated and die hard to the end. I mean, these are the same people who think folks who riot over Confederate statues are, they agree with Donald Trump that they're very fine people. This is another moment to sort of remember that phrase that was coined on this program years ago now, Cold Civil War. Corey Lewandowski had a bad day all around. And it was made worse by the fact that, given the misogynistic nature of the present Republican Party, those bad days were provided, as you heard from Ms. Dean and Ms. McCarthy Powell and Ms. Jackson Lee and now Pramila Jayapal. Those bad moments were provided by brilliant women who were not putting up with his shit. And I suspect the Democrats on the committee know this, because it makes it being upbraided by a mere female is very near the top of the list of things that will earn you the ire and the displeasure of Nitwit Nero. Because no one devalues women more than he does.
Washington.
Thank you. Mr. Lewandowski, what we're seeing here is a pattern of the president doing anything and everything to hide his misconduct from Congress and from the American people. The president tried to get you to deliver a secret message to the Attorney General, all in an attempt to prevent the special counsel from exposing the president's own misconduct. And as soon as the special counsel published his report and the president's misconduct was exposed, the president tried to cover that up too. Isn't it true that the president has repeatedly tried to discredit your and other witnesses' testimony to the special counsel in the published report?
Not to my knowledge.
You follow the president on Twitter, Mr. Lewandowski?
That's a good question.
Uh-oh. I have a feeling this is beginning to smell like a cross-examination.
Question.
Okay.
I'd have to check, but I think it's possible. I may be the only one who doesn't, but I'll fix that immediately. I'm sorry.
Excellent. You've probably seen his tweets, I imagine. Didn't the president say, and I'll put up the slide for you, statements are made about me by certain people in the crazy Mueller report, in itself written by 18 angry Democrat Trump haters, which are fabricated and totally untrue. That is a Trump tweet from April 19th, 2019. That's the president saying that all...
What would you pay to have her refer to it as a twoop?
The statements given by witnesses in the investigation, all those statements are untrue. Mr. Lewandowski, you were a witness in the investigation. You sat for interviews with the special counsel as part of the federal investigation. Isn't that correct?
I did sit, yes.
And the special counsel's report includes statements that you made to the special counsel during the federal investigation. Did you lie at any point to the special counsel during those interviews?
Not to the best of my recollection, no.
So your statements to the special counsel in the Mueller report, those are not, quote, fabricated and totally untrue. You didn't lie to the special counsel, did you, Mr. Lewandowski?
Not to the best of my recollection, no.
So the president is wrong that the report is fabricated and totally untrue. That's just the president trying to discredit all of the witnesses who said that he obstructed justice. Isn't that correct, Mr. Lewandowski?
That's a question for the president.
Well, which is it? I mean, did you lie, Mr. Lewandowski, or is the president wrong when he says that all of the statements in the report are fabricated?
I think I believe it says certain people. Statements made about me by certain people. It doesn't say all, unless I'm misreading it.
Mr. Lewandowski, did you lie to the president, and is the president correct that everything in the report is fabricated?
I won't comment on private conversations, but I don't appreciate the insinuation that I lied about anything. And
well,
I've answered it multiple times. I've answered your question multiple times about my truthfulness to the committee and the special counsel's office.
And I appreciate that, Mr. Lewandowski. But
I have not, to the best of my knowledge, lied to the special counsel.
Mr. Lewandowski, this is my time. You are not yet in the Senate. You are a witness before the Judiciary Committee. Please act like it. This is my time. I control it. The president also said, and please put up this slide, watch out.
Ouch.
For the people that take so-called notes when the notes never existed until needed. Referring to the Mueller report, referencing people taking notes of meetings with the president, notes that documented the president's obstruction. Mr. Lewandowski, you had notes from your meeting with the president. You've testified to that before us, correct?
Yes.
You were dictated those notes by the president, correct?
I believe that's in the report.
And you told the special counsel the president's dictated a message to you, and you said, write this down. This is volume 290, page 91. And you gave those notes to the special counsel, correct?
I can't speak to the way the special counsel has conducted their investigation or
did
what information they
the
have.
Did you give the notes to the special counsel? This is not about how the special counsel conducted its investigation.
That's a
it's
question
about whether
for,
you gave the notes to the special counsel.
That's a question for... Special Counsel Mueller.
Those were your notes, Mr. Lewandowski. They were in your safe. They were dictated to you and written down by you. Did you give them to the special counsel?
I comply with all legal and lawful requests of the special counsel.
Obviously, you are once again obstructing our investigation by refusing to answer questions that...
I've just answered your question. I said I comply with all requests by the special counsel.
So you gave the notes to the special counsel?
I've asked and answered your question.
Did you make up that the president told you to write down that note, Mr. Lewandowski?
I can't speak to private conversation I might not have had with the president of the United States.
Did you lie about the president telling you to write down the note?
That's not
a private conversation.
I believe what is in the report is an accurate description.
Okay. So to be clear, you also gave the special counsel notes from your meeting with the president that are not fabricated and totally untrue as per the president's tweet. So when the president said all those notes never existed until needed, that was his quote, that's just another instance of the president trying to discredit anyone who actually tried to document his misconduct. Now the president is going further, isn't he? You've said previously that you have nothing to hide and that you would answer all questions. Here's what you said. Can I play that clip?
I never asked for presidential immunity whatsoever. Chris, I sat there for 12 hours, and before I left, after the last 4 hours, I said, I will sit here for another 4 hours to answer every single one of your questions to the House Intelligence Committee. I said, before we leave today, I want to be very clear. I will sit and answer every one of your questions. There's no reason to subpoena me because I'm willing to volunteer if they want to ask me questions. I'll be happy to answer their questions because I have nothing to hide.
It's interesting, Mr. Lewandowski, because obviously the president does have something to hide because the White House is directing you not to answer the questions in front of the Judiciary Committee. And that is a tremendously shameful thing, Mr. Lewandowski. The American people deserve to know the truth, and I think they deserve to have you answer our questions.
Time of the...
So you get the idea as to the bellicose nature of Corey Lewandowski. He's sitting there. He thinks he's smarter than all of those, you know, women. But he's not. And he is caught red-handed. Smack dab in the middle of his of the consequences of his tireless, undying loyalty to Chlamydia Claudius. It's interesting, though, how changes in technology can change the proceedings themselves. Can you imagine having had video during the Nixon hearings to play back? And there were no cable news networks then. That was a clip of him with Chris Hayes. He was eager to get out there and say he'll answer any question, and then he came in and refused to answer questions based on a specious, spurious legal theory that anybody who ever said anything to Donald Trump doesn't have to say anything to anyone else. Barring intervention by Brat and Ann's boy Neil and Sammy shoot the black kid in the back of the head at 30 paces, Alito and Clarence pubes on the Coke can, Slappy Thomas and old balls and strikes John Roberts. The theory being put forward by the Trump regime wouldn't last a minute in a legitimate court. At least not if we apply the standards that were applied to Richard Nixon and applied in particular to William Jefferson Clinton. But this is a stall game. This is an attempt to keep things from getting nasty until the election year so that at the very least Trump can use the impeachment as a cudgel to say that he's being mistreated. Let's check in live with him now, though. Come on. Or are they wrapping up? Yeah, looks like they're splitting. Ah. Well, according to Darlene just a little bit ago, the House Judiciary Committee lambasted him counsel for the Judiciary Committee. And that's a wrinkle, because now counsel is getting to ask questions, which means that it cuts back on some of the grandstanding. Make no mistake, this is the beginning of something. Oh, look, there's Jim Shorts Jordan, who found his jacket but can't be brought to wear it as long as those Jezebel women's are wearing pants. What a freak show. And I'd like to say that this is their approach. This is how the Republicans are going to go about it. They are in the minority, but they're going to use the power that they have to make sure that this is a complete hash. But even so, they could not rehabilitate Corey Lewandowski. And if America was paying attention today, they saw Lewandowski for what he is. A liar? Arguably a criminal? And a co-conspirator. So if you want to talk about that later, we can certainly do that. The mention of inherent contempt. Well, you got to think that that will have some resonance. Brother Deacon Asa pointing out, knowing Chlamydia Claudius's fragile little ego, he'll probably fire Lewandowski after watching this for merely not following his doucheness on Twitter. That's good. But meanwhile, like I said, Venerial Vespasian is in California this evening, raking up money. And he'll probably come back with a pocket full or bags full, because as much as California broadly despises the cantaloupe Caligula, well, there are a bunch of rich bastards who are more than willing to give him money. And so he's doing a fundraiser in 90210 and in San Diego and in San Francisco. Here's the funny thing, though. There are a lot of people who are eager to give him a lot of money, but they're not eager for anybody to know who they are. They're actively trying to hide it. It's downright funny. Because, among other things, I think it was the Beverly Hills fundraiser. Politico reported, attendees at Tuesday's event are not being provided with the address of the actual luncheon. They're being told to meet at a shuttle location. The concern comes after news of the Hollywood area fundraiser sparked controversy when actors Deborah Messing and Eric McCormick called for outing attendees. Demonstrators have been trying to ferret out locations of the fundraisers, promising to stage protests and appearances by the giant baby Trump balloon. That's right. The President of the United States is scared of a balloon. Yeah. So these people want to give him money, but they don't want to be known as collaborators. Because, well, they might not be, well, they might not be on the A-list anymore for all those swell soirees. I say out them. If you're ashamed to for people to know where you're putting your money, then why would you why wouldn't you be ashamed to? I mean, why own it? That's all. Just own it. Thousands of GOP donors, bundlers, and state party officials are looking to participate. Two events in Beverly Hills, another one in Silicon Valley, and one in San Diego. You know, at least the people who supported the guy with the little Charlie Chaplin mustache acted like they were proud of it. God. But yeah, he's gonna make a shit ton of money. Even though in California he's got the worst approval rating of just about anywhere in the country, down by like 30 points. So it would be nice to find out who some of these big dollar donors are. And then you know, figure, well, what kind of business are you in, buddy? And you let the free market, because Republicans love them from some free market, don't they? Let the free market take it from there. Now, we're not stupid. Our side isn't going to go out and blow up coolers or set fire to sneakers or anything. But going forward, yeah. Yeah. Subject line, Doug Collins and his narrative bullshit. Steve in New York writes, if the GOP were in the majority and a Democrat would have said what Collins said, the chair would have gaveled him down. I'm sorry, Bob, but the Democrats are showing themselves to be the milquetoast they are. What should have happened was the committee should have immediately voted on contempt motion, and upon passing, Nadler should have ordered Lewandowski jailed in the jail in the basement. Then, if the House could have voted on any contempt motion and made it retroactive, there would be no due process issue, because contempt, as you know, is not a criminal issue. As the old saying goes, in contempt, the contemnor holds the keys to his own cell. Yeah. I'm not quite ready to declare them a bunch of sissy milquetoasts. But they're moving carefully, because this is a weighty matter. But even for maggots, well, they don't want to go down with the ship, and they sense that Trump is sinking. You know, we talk about his limitations. We talk here about his intellectual disabilities. But no one knows it better than Republicans do. And so now there are officially 18 Republicans who have already said, fuck it, I'm done. The latest is Representative Paul Cook from California. And he's just leaving. He's been there for 8 years. He's a four-term Republican. And the district he represents was carried by Donald Trump by more than 10 points. And he said, screw it. Now I'm done. He's going to quit the Congress. At least he's not going to go and, like that poltroon from North Carolina, he's not going to teach his grandson to fish. No, he's going to quit so he can run for the San Bernardino County Board of Supervisors. It's a bit of a step down, isn't it? But he figures he can win there. Not so much. His own congressional district. Goodbye, Paul. Try not to let the door hit you on the way out. Where the good Lord split you. Now, this is a guy who just last November took 60% of the vote in his district. That's a little bit telling. Oh, I said it wrong. I'm sorry, Brother Deacon Asa Point. It's San Bernardino. San Bernardino. Alexander pointing out, and Alexander's out in California. Yeah, these Californian trolls don't want to be known because it would hurt their careers, their profit margins, their businesses, their social status, etc. I loathe cowardly, hypocritical people, regardless of where they reside and who they are. They should be called out, lambasted, and shamed. Yep. As to Paul Cook, bye-bye, bye-bye, biatch. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Here, here. I'm going to run for the Board of Supervisors. I'm tired of being a member of the Congress. Heck of a day. Let's see, check Darlene in Connecticut says, he was downright disrespectful, Lewandowski was, to all the Dems on the committee and pandering to the Republicans. It was so apparent. I think he acted disgracefully to Sheila Jackson Lee. I was shocked, quite frankly. Maybe pulling a bit of a Kavanaugh, and he clearly used Mueller's technique of refusing to read from the Mueller report. New precedents have been set. So the committee's in break. They didn't knock off entirely. So we'll check in with that here in a couple of minutes. As to anonymous Trumpansies, Steve in New York merely says, talk about snowflakes. Cali Republican money. Clarence says, I bet he gets a check from John Voight. What a disappointment. I was a big fan of John. His political views have destroyed my fan support. Well, imagine poor Tracy having to run into him there from time to time. So, other stuff? Well, over there in the Intelligence Committee, formerly headed by Devin Nunes. You recall Devin Nunes sued Twitter trying to find out who the parody account Devin Nunes's cow is. Twitter laughed at Devin Nunes over that. Good for, yeah. Every now and then, Jack gets it right. And now, in an effort to pogo stick up onto the cross, Dev has claimed in a lawsuit, he's gone a little lawsuit crazy, that his wife has been doxxed and that it's occasioned, by progressives. Progressives have doxxed her. And that they're having to spend lots more money on security at the school. There's only one problem, as McClatchy found out. It's a complete fiction. Investigating Nunez's claim, they discovered that no teachers at the school indicated that anything had happened by way of harassment. The school said, no, we don't have any increased security. All of this because Devin Nunes is desperate to keep his sleaze and his graft and his filth and his corruption quiet. Jesus. All over a public records request. Campaign for Accountability. Noted that emails from a public records request were part of their complaint against Nunez back a year and a couple of months ago. They complained that he had not properly disclosed his financial interests. And so an email was sent to Elizabeth Nunez and it had to do with paperwork and funds to become a partner in a wine company called Phase Two Cellars. And this is what Devin Nunez is bawling about. Jesus. This also has to do with the fact that he calls himself a farmer. On ballots for the election. Now, the superintendent of the Sundale school system did tell McClatchy that they'd spent $17,000 in legal fees responding to the records request. Oh, well. But Devin Nunez still thinks he's being treated unfairly, despite all the sleazy shit that Devin Nunez has done over the last couple of years. And on the world stage, looky here. It's election day in Israel. And in quite the shocker, the psycho, Bibi Netanyahu, looks to be losing. The Jerusalem Post reporting that there's no clear winner in the election, but that Psycho Bibi has not gotten a victory. Wow. So, watch this space. Because along the way, the Attorney General of Israel has noted that he's probably going to indict Bibi for fraud, bribery, and breach of trust. You know, Trump behavior. Early next month. What's interesting, though, is that knowing he was in trouble, he focused toward the end of the campaign on trying to secure the support of what are described as right-wing nationalists in Israel. The other word for that is fascists, because he is one. Among other things, Psycho Bibi promised that he would just flat out annex the Jordan Valley in the occupied West Bank. That's a third of the occupied West Bank. He also pulled a Trump and said voter fraud in Arab communities might steal the vote from him. He's used the Trump tactic of calling his opponents weak and leftist, because there's a lot of socialism in Israel, so the socialist charge really doesn't fly. So with any luck at all, maybe the world may soon be rid of Bibi Netanyahu, a stone-cold psychopath. Let's check back in the hearing, shall we?
Here today, despite duly issued subpoenas from this committee. As I discussed in my opening statement, I strongly disagree with the White House's assertion of absolute immunity. As to Mr. Dearborn and Mr. Porter, we are considering all available options to enforce these subpoenas. We welcome Mr. Lewandowski, and we thank him for participating in today's hearing. And if it please rise, I will begin by swearing you in.
Wait a minute. That's not the hearing. I mean, it's a hearing, but that's the. I guess that's a rerun. I can't sit here and just watch it and wait and see what... if they're on break, apparently they're still on break. Because that's the swearing in. No, it's over. It's over. Yeah, it wasn't a break. Okay. Well, here we are at the end of the first hour. And, yeah, exactly. Brother Deacon Asa says, in other words, Israeli maggots. I guess they would be miggots. Make Israel great again. Trump supporters. Miggins. But maggots, you know, it's got a certain panache. Like I said, we're at the end of the first hour of the program. And we've got $390 to raise. We're still at $390 to raise. And hopefully, we will knock some of that down somewhere along the way. Oh, and speaking of, this was yesterday, but over at the third floor of the Department of Homeland Security in D.C., somebody found a hand-drawn swastika on the wall. It's over at the Nebraska Avenue complex in D.C., Staffers were told about it by Principal Deputy Undersecretary for the Office of Intelligence and Analysis, Brian Murphy. In the email, Murphy said, "Unfortunately, today a hand-drawn swastika was located on the third floor. First, I want to repeat what the Secretary and many others in the Department have said in the past. There is no room in the workplace for such symbols of hate, and there is no room in the workplace for those who ascribe to such a thing. I have communicated with USIA Glaw, who is currently in Israel, and he is disgusted by what has happened." What's the Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis doing in Israel right at election time? So, just a reminder that, yes, we have a bigger Nazi problem in this country than the vast majority of people dare to acknowledge. Homeland Security. Aren't they the folks that run Customs and Border Protection? Patrol, Aren't they the ones who run the ICE thugs? And, of course, Murphy then said, we have no tolerance in our workplace for such acts of hate. And this email is just the next step in our communication and action plan. Here's the funny part. One of the employees who received the email accidentally hit reply all and said, check out the latest INA, that means intelligence and analysis, insanity, as if leadership really cares. I guess I should not be surprised. And Murphy got it and said, I do care. And then there's Andrew Meehan, the acting, they're all acting. We got a government of actors. Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at DHS. That means he's a spokes creep. He said, the display of hate and cowardice does not represent the dedicated, hardworking men and women of the Department of Homeland Security. There is no place in an organization that works tirelessly to protect American people and combat hate in all its forms. The situation was immediately referred to the Office of the Inspector General, currently being investigating to ensure its swift and corrective actions taken. There's only one problem. It does represent the dedicated and hardworking men and women of the Department of Homeland Security. If it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, or better yet, if it honks like a goose and it steps like a goose, it's a Nazi. So all that bullshit about there's no room, it happened. So obviously there's room. Seems fairly plain to me. Meanwhile, earlier today, the attempt to provide a Gulf of Tonkin moment in the ongoing bloodlust of the desire to hire out the military to the Saudis, the Pentagon now claims that it has. Sure they do. That it has satellite photos that show the Iranians getting ready to launch missiles and drones from Iranian soil toward the facility at Abqaiq. Yeah. And they've got pictures with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one. George Conway, and I never know quite what to make of his trollery. I think that about half the time he's just trying to keep heat off of his wife. But today he tweeted he sharpied the Constitution of the United States. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. Now, according to George Conway, now reads, the Saudi royal family shall have the power to declare war. Because, well, the Saudis pay cash. And some news out of Scotland. You know, Trump loves Scotland, except for the wind turbines. I do. On the one hand, The grafty, grifty business with the United States Air Force continues. It turns out that some aircraft crew members, yeah, they overnighted at Turnberry. Some officers, however, got extended days-long stays with perks like Scottish shortbread and little pins, you know, commemorative pins, pride pins, they're called, I believe, because they won, you know, they participated in the Battle of Turnberry or something. So the amount of money that we, the people, have ponied up to put up members of the U.S. military at a seedy, grifty, nasty little resort in Scotland, well, that's getting worse. Hell, that may be its own little article of impeachment. Some people may lose, if there's any justice at all, several people will lose the brass off of their shoulder boards. But now, according to Politico, ha-ha! And since, according to Politico, a bunch of Saudi dirtbags have been hanging out at the Turnberry Resort. A party of 25 people and more than 100 pieces of luggage. Now that there's what you call your foreign emolument. And that there is illegal according to the Constitution. Yeah, some of the Air Force officers have even played a round of golf on the track there at Turnberry. Just to give you an idea of the money being spent, a kid's T-shirt at Turnberry is about $68. The graft never ends. Here's something that would be fun to run a fundraiser for. Apparently, the home in which Tangerine Tiberius was raised is for sale. It's just a shitty little house in Jamaica, Queens. And they put it on the market for $2.9 million. The owners, a company bought it for $2.14 million. They work with a law firm, and the law firm in turn represents Chinese investors. That transaction took place in 2017. But the Chinese investors are trying to offload it now. And it won't sell. So it's going to go under the hammer. It's going to go under the gavel. It's going to go on the auction block, according to a story in the New York Times. Because the Chinese investors couldn't snooker anybody into shelling out $2.9 million for a place that's probably held together by bedbugs. It's a 5-bedroom house. And it's decorated with pictures of Julius Caesar. Paramount Realty, which is run by someone named Misha Hagani, said, I'm sure there are investors, especially Trump supporters, maybe even some Trump haters, who would love to buy the property. Misha is right. I think it would be an absolute blast to buy that place, bulldoze it, salt the earth, grind what is left into a fine dust, burn it, and then dump the ashes right there in front of that tacky-ass Trump Tower. And just say, hey, look, just so you know, there's not going to be any statues to you, Donnie. In fact, everything that has your name on it will be eventually torn down, and we will do everything in our power to make sure that the entire world forgets that you ever walked upon it. The Latin term for that is damnatio memoriae, damnation of memory. Would that be fun? But I don't know. What'll be especially hilarious is if it goes on the auction block and they can't even get the 2.14 out of it that the Chinese investors paid, thinking that they were going to curry some favor with Donald Trump. Yeah. Oh, and I mentioned the trip to California. Well, it was late this morning, California time, when he arrived. He'll be out there for 2 days. I mentioned that he expects to haul in about $15 million for Trump victory, which is a scam being run by the Trump campaign in conjunction with the RNC. And I guess his signature issue is going to be going after California for homelessness. It's not like there's no homelessness elsewhere, but he has said, we can't let Los Angeles, San Francisco, and numerous other cities destroy themselves by allowing what's happening. People can't believe what's happening. We have people living in our best highways, our best streets, our best entrances to buildings. Really? There's a list of those? Best building entrances? Where people in those buildings pay tremendous taxes, where they went to those locations because of the prestige. In many cases, they came from other countries, like Russia, and moved to Los Angeles, or they moved to San Francisco because of the prestige of the city, and all of a sudden they have tents. Hundreds and hundreds of tents, and people living at the entrance to their office building, and they want to leave, and the people of San Francisco are fed up, and the people of Los Angeles are fed up. And so he plans to have discussions with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, run by, you'll recall, the guy who thinks that the pyramids of Egypt are big triangular grain silos. That would be Dr. Ben Carson, who has a portrait of him and his buddy Jesus in his house. Now, this is something we can discuss because we've got a lot of friends and members of the Horn Family Community Congregation in California. I'm surprised there was no mention in this story. I'm surprised that Nitwit Nero didn't start babbling about the poopy on the sidewalks in San Francisco, because that seems to be a real point of fascination for the little white-winged trolls who support the maggots, who are the maggots. And I know that housing is brutally expensive in California, and I know that there's a homelessness problem. But did you notice in the quote there, it's not that he's worried about homeless people, he just despises them on principle. No, he's worried about the building entrances. He's worried about our best highways, our best streets. Because people, people, they can't give him, the homeless people can't give him money. What use is it, what use are they to him? Explain something, Ron in Raleigh writes. The Saudis have been bombing the piss out of Yemen for quite some time. The Yemenis, even if they did have and did use Iranian proxies, don't have the right to retaliate? That seems to be the narrative our for-profit media and government are laying down. They're also calling the Yemeni and Houthis terrorists. Seems that if you're going to call anyone terrorists, it would be the Saudis and the UAE and the U.S. I'm asking for a friend, says Ron. Well, see, again, it's kind of like the buildings and the roads and the bridges. They're more important than people. And so by extension, that oil facility at Abqaiq is more important than the mommies and the daddies and the little baby Yemenis that the Saudis, without so much as the bat of an eyelash, blast into little tiny molecular constituent pieces, otherwise known as a red mist. Because, you know, they're not the right people. They're not Saudi princes and princesses and princelings like the princess yesterday who made the plumber kiss her hairy toe in Paris. I mean, there's terrorism and there's terrorism. Somehow, I think that bringing on starvation and disease epidemics and just outright slaughtering people, that feels terroristic. But the Saudis are, of course, our partners in peace. And the closest thing that Israel has to a friend in an Arab nation. And so, well, all pigs are equal, but some pigs are more equal than other pigs. See Animal Farm. I think we had a reference to Animal Farm last night. And we do know, and it's weird that we would take comfort in this, but Trump is a chicken shit. He's always been a chicken shit. He likes to talk bluster, but like any bully, once you punch him in the nose, he recoils. And then it tries to find some way to get at you from behind. And with the exception of lobbing a few million dollars worth of explosive hardware at a runway in Syria, he hasn't done much. He saber rattles. But the thing about saber rattling is the only reason that the saber rattles is that it is because it is still in its sheath. In its scabbard. And I think he knows full well that the United States is not going to want to go to war for oil again because, yeah, we did that once. And look how that's working out. Terrace with a note, war on homeless. If King Dong solves the housing problem without more concentration camps, we will erect those statues in his memory. And of course, continues Terrace, he won't. And we won't. Homeless and Trump, says Lee in New York. Do you remember that Trump compared himself to a homeless person because that person had a larger net worth? Here's the quote.
I remember once my father and I were walking down Fifth Avenue, and there was a homeless person sitting right outside of Trump Tower, and I remember my father pointing to him and saying, you know, that guy has $8 billion more than me, because he was in such extreme debt at that point, you know? Okay, that was actually a precious Ivanka quote. Who, by the way, says she got her moral compass from her daddy. I'm willing to believe that. Oh, we have a correction here. No, says Brother Deacon Asa. It would be insane to knock down Trump's boyhood home. What are you thinking? It'd be absolutely perfect if someone bought it and turned it into a tribute museum to Barack Hussein Obama. A shrine of sorts. Now that would have Nitwit Nero writhing in agony for the rest of his miserable, misbegotten life. See, I count on you guys. Y'all are ahead of the game. That's perfect. The greater New York metro area Barack Hussein Obama Museum. And maybe there could be a Hillary wing, too. It's five bedrooms. There could be a Hillary Museum there, too. Go for the double down and what's the phrase that was it Todd who coined it? Stoke the stroke. Yeah. I like it. Oh, let's see. Pay attention, Kentucky. Kentucky, I believe, is one of those states. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kyle, or any of the other members of the Kentucky contingent of the Horn Family Community Congregation. Kentucky's one of those states that has an off-year gubernatorial election. And I think other offices as well. Yesterday, the Kentucky Democratic Party publicized the fact that more than 150,000 registered Kentucky voters have been improperly put on an inactive list by the State Board of Elections. They weren't inactive. They were not supposed to be. Right. And that means that come November and the elections, those 150,000 people may try to go and vote and find out that they can't. The chairman of the Kentucky Democratic Party is Ben Self. And yesterday he got a little head up and outright demanded that those registrations be reactivated by the State Board of Elections. No surprise, the State Board did it behind closed doors. There was no public input. There was no public notice that the meeting was going to take place. The board was supposed to meet today, and I haven't heard what their determination was. And they never would have known, nobody would have ever known if Ben Self and the state party hadn't requested voter registration data from the Board of Elections. Meanwhile, Jennifer Scutchfield is the assistant director of the Board of Elections, and she said, well, she just doesn't know if they're going to talk about it at the meeting today. And she hadn't seen no letter from no Democrat party. Going back to the issue of homelessness, Robert in Australia says, Soylent Green is homeless. Let's hope the loser's never seen the movie Soylent Green.
Hey, that's a great idea. We free up the entrances to buildings and solve the homeless problem. and we can sell it through the mail. Trump, Soylent Trump. They were probably liberals anyway.
Meanwhile, Keith says, as to Trump's boyhood home, why not turn it into a homeless shelter and community advocacy center? That's beyond anything that Trump would ever think of. Yeah, that'd piss him off. Probably piss off the neighborhood, too. No, I still think the leading contender is Ace's idea. Oh, and just to sort of get away from some of the nastiness that we've been dealing with for the first half of the program. By the way, we're still at minus 390. Today is one of those, today so far has been one of those goose egg days. I'd really like for us not to be at 590 by tomorrow. No. We're finding out more and more what the impact of plastics have been on our planet and our species. Last night, Brother Deacon Asa said it sounded like I was doing dishes in the background. Well, that's because I'm trying to get away from some plastics, and so I've got a nice metal double-walled, keeps things cold, hot things hot, cold things cold. I prefer my water cold. Water bottle. Day late and a dollar short, I'm sure. But still, yeah, it's in the effort. Well, the German Environment Ministry and the Robert Koch Institute, we're not talking about Chuck and Still Dead Dave, have done a study on children. And they tested 2,500 children between 2014 and 2017. The findings of the study were published in Der Spiegel, the Mirror, this past Saturday, because the German government, you know, nanny state, wanted to do human biomonitoring of 3 to 17-year-old children. In 97 to 100% of blood and urine samples from those 2,500 children, they found traces of 11 out of 15 plastic ingredients. Marika Kolasa-Gehring, one of the authors of the study, said, "Our study clearly shows that plastic ingredients which are rising in production are also showing up more and more in the body. It's really worrying that the youngest children are most affected as the most sensitive group. There were high levels of perfluoroarsenic acid, PFOA. It bioaccumulates, it persists in the body, and it's toxic as hell, and yes, it's what they use for nonstick cookware and waterproofing clothing. 20% of the test samples were above the limit. And in the youngest kids, it was even higher than that 20%. Turns out if you're poor, you're more likely to have more plastic in your body than children from higher income families. C- God damn. Because, well, as is always the case in environmental justice, poverty communities are the ones that get the shit dumped on them. Even in enlightened Euro states. Among other things, perfluorooctanoic acid harms the reproductive system. It also wrecks the liver. In 2020, a global ban of perfluorooctanoic acid will go into effect. But there will, of course, be exceptions. One individual said, "It cannot be that every fourth child between the ages of 3 and 5 is so heavily burdened with chemicals that long-term damage cannot be reliably ruled out. The federal government must make every effort to protect people from harmful chemicals. Provision is an obligation." But not for poor kids. Well, maybe in Germany they'll do something. Maybe in the EU they'll do something. Here, though, well, similar chemicals have poisoned an entire region of West Virginia along the Ohio River because of a DuPont plant that was making nonstick coating. Now, the Green Party in Europe is not the same as the Green Party here. The Green Party in Europe is actually somewhat viable and not made up of loonies. The Green Party was the one that made inquiry into the effects of chemicals on public health. And that's how the German research was made publicly available. And it turns out that it's sort of that you have a mouse problem, so you get a cat, and then you have a cat problem, so you get a dog, and pretty soon you're up to elephants. Well, when you ban a chemical, one of the things they found out is when you ban a chemical, you get a replacement chemical, and it turns out to be equally dangerous. And this is stuff in among other things, cosmetics, toys, medical devices. The EU, in the ban of this stuff that goes into effect next year, the EU insisted on an exception for medical devices and medical clothing. That means that somebody out there will still be making money poisoning communities. And they never put these plants, remember, they never put these plants next to wealthy people's mansions. Also, microplastics are falling like snow in the Arctic. 99% of Americans have similar Teflon chemicals in our blood. That's called C8. A baby emerges into the world, newborn, with C8 in its umbilical cord blood and the mother's breast milk. C8 is, in fact, perfluoro octanoic acid. You might recall that this chemical was part of the documentary "The Devil We Know." Remember, this stuff did not even exist 100 years ago. And now it's wrecking human biological systems all over the world. Wow. Because, of course, we do not have the precautionary principle. We have the capitalism principle. Hey, we found some sciencey stuff, and if we make the stuff we found with the sciencey stuff, we can make a lot of money doing it. Is it poison? Don't know. Could it wreck little babies' bodies? Don't care. Check clear? Yeah, cool. Make more. That's capitalism. And then when you try to put the genie back in the bottle, that proves to be damnably difficult to accomplish. And then there's carbon black. We have a report from researchers announcing the publication in Nature Communications of a study on carbon black particles in the placentas of pregnant women. Somewhere along the way, it'd be nice if some of those pro-life fuckers would pay attention to some of this stuff. We're talking about babies that are wanted, yearned for, loved. And they enter the world with microparticles from vehicle exhaust and coal-fired power plants. And the research found this stuff in the fetus-facing side of mother's placentas. And the more mothers were exposed to airborne pollutants on a daily basis, the more the baby got. The authors of the study in Nature Communications said, "Our studies provide compelling evidence for the presence of black carbon particles originating from air pollution in human placenta." We have known about this for a while in Appalachia because we're the canary in the coal mine. We know what happens to pregnant mothers who live in the mountaintop removal sacrifice zone. And now we're finding out that it extends well away from the area. Among other things, you get low birth weight. That means that later on in life, baby will have a higher risk for diabetes, for asthma, for stroke, for heart disease. And what this study does is it explains how the air pollution gets to the newborns. Christine Giassone, who is with the Brain Health Research Center at the University of Otago in New Zealand, offering comment on the study, said, "The new study sheds some light on this by showing that inhalation of black carbon particles can accumulate in the placenta. In order to get the data, the Belgian scientist who did the research said that they had 23 full-term and 5 preterm births with which they could examine the placenta. And lo and behold, what Tim Nalrot found, black carbon particles are able to translocate from the mother's lungs to the placenta. And, of course, the research work of Dr. Michael Hendricks, who has been so critical to the underlying science of the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, H.R. 2050, if you'd like to call your representative and ask him to co-sponsor it, this would be a great time. Well, we know that ultrafines from blasting in mountaintop removal areas, we know that they transit the placental barrier because that's how tiny they are. And so it's not just the silica dust that pregnant mothers inhale around here. It's the carbon stuff, too. You know, we'd probably be breathing a lot less carbon if we were a lot more serious about solar and wind energy. And I really don't think the numbers from windmill cancer would be that high. This is simply because we burn coal and we burn hydrocarbons to run our vehicles. Newsflash, guess who doesn't give a shit about any of this? Yay, the Saudis! They want to pump more oil. The Iranians want to pump more oil. The planet is on fire! And these assholes want to pump more oil because money. Money, 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 money. Now here's how little it takes. A high level of black carbon exposure for a pregnant woman is 2.42 micrograms per cubic meter. A meter up, a meter down, a meter to the side, a cube. micrograms. And that was enough to jack up the rates of black carbon particles in the placenta dramatically. Burn that coal, y'all. Burn that oil. A researcher named Jennifer Salmond, an associate professor at the University of Auckland School of Environment, said, "Perhaps the most alarming aspect of this study is that black carbon particles from air that is not even considered to be particularly polluted by WHO standards is nonetheless accumulating in the placenta." And all this, at a time when the Trump regime has said that the air in California is just too clean. Because they've got some loopy-ass scientist, I'm not kidding, who says that breathing that filth confers some immunity on people. I think we ran his testimony once as a soundbite here. If I was one for going in for believing in the devil, I would say that the Trump regime, including Trump himself, are devils. That they are agents of Satan on earth, bent on destruction. Because how else do you describe such intentionally destructive conduct? Wanting more people to be subjected to more harm. C8 and carbon black. Damn. And I know you might think it's a bit of an overstatement. But I cannot imagine what this country is on, say, January the 20th, 2025, if we do not cut out the cancer that is Donald Trump by January 20th, 2021. It will not be recognizable. It will not be the world even that you think you live in now. So let's run over the Skype line and check in with Scott. Scott didn't get in last night because of the other conversation that was going on. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Oh, you know, black carbon, C8. I couldn't be happier. But, hey, at least Trump's not coming to my town. He's coming to yours, bub.
Oh, I know. I was going to talk about that. Jesus. Definitely a disturbance in the force. My timing was a little bit off tonight. I'm stirring my second cup of El Cheapo coffee. Now I must rinse the spoon.
El Cheapo, when you really don't give a fuck about your coffee.
Hey. Come on now. I doubt that I could drink a real cup of coffee at this point. I mean, this is real. This once was coffee, this dry stuff in the jar. It's just that all the moisture has been taken out, and I add my own moisture. It's like gravy train. Add warm water, stir, makes its own gravy right in the bowl. All you add is love. So there. Do they even make gravy? Sit.
Yeah, and I don't think they make Gaines burgers either.
No, you don't see those. And there was another dog food that they used to advertise the hell out of it. I believe it was made by the Quaker Oats Company. That'll give you pause as you enjoy your Barbara Bush Quaker Oats or your Life cereal tomorrow morning. What the hell was in Kennel Ration that Quaker Oats people were making it once upon a time?
But, you know, the funny thing is, those little Gaines burgers, when I was a kid, we had a little Yorkshire Terrier. And, I mean, up into my adulthood. He lasted 18 years on a steady diet of Gaines burgers.
Yeah, all it is regular dog food that has been run through an extruder to, I forget what the technical word is, like an extruder with a plate with a bunch of holes, and they run the dog food through it, and it makes it stringy.
It wasn't wet and sloppy, it was crumbly. Canned dog food.
I don't know.
And
how
it was
they
just
did
each
then.
Little burger was wrapped in cellophane.
I remember. Yeah. And some of them you can get it with cheese, little chunks of artificial cheese in there. God, now I'm making myself hungry, Bob. How did I start this?
We went from coffee to dog food, and that's on you.
Well, that's because they changed the layout in the.
But you know what? You mentioned Quaker Oats and Kennel Ration. I don't think they make it anymore, but I grew up eating Ralston hot cereal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I haven't had it either for years.
Yeah, and who made that?
Purina. Yeah. And do you know whose family headed up that company?
No.
Or played a big part in it? Danforth, the fellow who sponsored... What's his name? Clarence Slappy Thomas. Yeah, the Danforth family was real big with the Ralston Company or Purina, I believe. Somebody can look that up. I don't know. I'm telling you, it's not a heartening thing. I woke up late today, so it's not a heartening thing when you wake up, you fire up the old laptop, you're scrolling down the front page of the online Washington Post, top headline, Trump officials to revoke California's power to set auto emission standards. And then you go down a little lower, how white supremacists try to recruit boys online. Trump says homeless people hurt the prestige of Los Angeles and San Francisco. Cokie Roberts dead. And that's just at the top of the fold, you know. Corey Lewandowski breaking bad in front of the damn Senate panel, mocking them, laughing. If we don't, usher this fellow to the door, by this fellow, I mean Mr. Trump, when we have our next opportunity, I'm telling you, you were right. I mean, January 20th, 2025, it's going to look like, what was that Harrison Ford movie set in the future?
Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. It's going to look worse than Blade Runner. And by the way, as far as Trump's boyhood home, I think there's one of the cable channels has a paranormal detective group. They need to dispatch the paranormal detective, the Ghost Hunters group or whatever, and find out if there's not a portal to hell itself, directly to hell. Do not pass go somewhere on the premises of Trump's boyhood home. I mean, I don't know that I believe in the devil either, at least as proclaimed by the religious establishment. But I do believe in forces of positive or good and forces of negative or evil. And damned if that guy isn't just the epitome, the poster child of just evilness. It drips off of him. It's disgusting. It's frightening. It's like you don't even have to be taught anything. You don't even have to know anything necessarily. If your inner spirit or whatever is attuned to picking up these distinctions among or between people, you know inherently when somebody is giving off that vibe, they radiate it. I know that sounds very, you know, very religious in quotes, but it's not meant to be. I mean, if there's not evil in the dynamic in which we live, how do you go to explain the untold abuses through history? I mean, it can't just be human nature, because if it were human nature, all of us would be doing it. All of us would be engaging. I mean, there are some decent people. I mean, you're a decent person. I like to think that I'm a decent person. And I guess these are the questions that human beings have been dancing with ever since we got the ability to think about things. But there's got to be some explanation to account for the attitude and behavior and goals and just the standard operating procedure of these people.
Well, that's okay. But I mean, we have to understand them for who they are. They don't care about anything but money and power. That's it. And so, but they act accordingly.
What's under that? What drives that? There's got to be a force or something that compels people to be that way. There's something in their wiring, I think, that they've not been able or have chose willingly, more likely, not to transcend. Because, I mean, everybody on the planet could theoretically behave in a similar manner to how these people are behaving, these evil right-wing fascist conservative, neoconservative, Nazi, white power. And you can't even say crazy, because there are impaired people, mentally impaired people, walking the streets. Trump wants to round them up because they take away the prestige, who are perfectly harmless to themselves and to people around them. They're just not quite all there or something. I'm not a doctor. Hell, what do I know? But I do know the difference between someone who is just moving along as best they can, doing the best they can, and doesn't want to hurt themselves, doesn't want to hurt me, doesn't want to hurt you, and someone.
But see, that's what's wrong. That's what's wrong with them. You know, the work, the study has actually been done, the scholarship, and we know that psychopaths and sociopaths exist at a certain percentage in the population as a whole. It's just one of those things about, you know, us upright walking hairless primates.
Yeah.
Largely hairless. But what happens is when you start looking at CEO culture, there is a disproportionate number of sociopaths and psychopaths in those ranks. So understanding that correlation is not causation, I think it's fair to say that the high ranks of corporate culture draw sociopaths and psychopaths the same way that pedophiles are drawn to Cub Scout packs and the priesthood. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
And it probably applies to politics as well. You know, Agnes and I were talking the other day, and I said, look, and I've said it on the program too, anybody who wants to be president of the United States, I mean, we need to understand this about them. Both parties, I'm not trying to be damnatory, but in order to want to be president of the United States, especially now in the so-called modern era, you got to have something wrong with you. It's not a feature. It's a flaw.
Yeah.
You've got to have a character flaw that makes you want to be president of the United States.
Yeah, because think of all the hoops that you jump through, and the stuff that you must do in order to get that lofty prize. And then there's it's part of that mindset, that description of your typical candidate, that generally speaking, most people who reach the point where they could actually be elected president have probably sold out in meaningful ways along the way to get to that point. So it's a matter of their internal wiring, and it's a matter of, I don't know if it's exactly what Lyndon Johnson used to talk about, you got to go along to get along, but there is no small bit of that activity going on. And there's a difference between go along to get along and compromise, as meant in the most honorable sense of compromise and working together to craft something that works for the most people possible. Or am I missing an aspect in that? I hope not, because that
I don't think
I've
so.
I've kind of bought into that that notion, you know, and that's what fucks us up. You know, sometimes people buy into notions that are no damn good for them. Okay, so we've explained the mindset that's prevalent in these evildoers, to borrow a page from George W. Bush, And they truly, to my mind, are evildoers. Now, what is it that prevails or presents in voters who are, and I, God knows I didn't call to get all metaphysical today, but these things intrigue me, Bob, because really it's like medicine. If we're going to find a solution or a cure, we've got to know what the fucking diagnosis is and make our best efforts to figure out what's going on with these people. And by these people, I not only mean the candidates, but I mean the fucking people, the electorate, these Nimrods who vote for them. I mean, it can't just be white supremacy. It can't just be a wannabe sort of mentality thinking, foolishly, I think, that, oh, if I support this guy and we elect these people and we let them run the place for a while.
But let me back up for a minute. Why can't it just be white supremacy? I mean, it was enough to provide the driving force of this entire nation from jump. It touches everything in American life. Why can't it just be? I'm not saying it is. I'm asking you to tell me why.
Well, I'm not saying that it can't just be. I'm wondering if that type of attitude, the attitude of a human being who would take another human being and ship that man or woman over here, okay, and put them to work and in deplorable conditions and not give them the dignity that automatically goes with being a human being. I don't know that that's necessarily white supremacy. That it shows up to everybody as white supremacy, but what's beneath that? Where is that coming from? Do you get the distinction that I'm trying to make? And I'm certainly not trying to pave, you know, a cushy, you know, I don't want to let anybody off the hook. But at the same time,
so are you saying there's some religious or philosophical underpinning?
No, there's something in their being. In what drives them. There's some elemental thing in people that causes them to behave in a way that's appropriate and positive, or a way that's inappropriate or negative. And maybe this is not the place for that discussion. I don't know. And maybe
You're getting down into the kind of weeds that Plato and Socrates wandered around in. You know, what is justice?
What is truth? That kind of thing.
And it has bedeviled us for 2,500 years.
And in this context, Bob, I'll admit it. It could very well be a pointless exercise.
Well, here, let me. It's nothing by way of an answer, but let me point something out.
Yeah.
The things that you're describing, the anthropologists have told us, are generally not part of hunter-gatherer societies.
Yeah, because hunter-gatherers are cooperative folks, because they need to be.
I mean, you can have misbehavior,
you can
have outright bad acting, but it's dealt with swiftly, and generally successfully. So, if that's the case, then you look for the root of it, which is what you're going at, in the rise of sedentary society, in the rise of agriculture, in the rise of the written word. How's about that for blowing your mind?
Run it by me again, because I'm not catching it.
Well, if the things you're describing
basically, are you saying that the shift occurred or was in the process of occurring because of the nature of our societies, in the sense that at one point,
well, there's a transition thousands of years ago, from hunting and gathering to sedentary agricultural society that persists to this day.
Okay.
It enables massive population explosions. The idea of war, the real kind, sustained, bloody, and devastating, comes with it. Writing comes with it because writing arises in Mesopotamia because you've got to be able to keep track of how many bags of barley the farmer owes to the chief or the king.
Yeah, accounting.
The origins of writing are accounting. Because you have to be able to show numbers and you have to be able to say what the thing is. Barley or jugs of beer or... Yeah.
Just parenthetically, Bob, put a book note there. Isn't that because we also have the wiring, we also have the attribute of being people who put high importance upon measuring, comparative. Isn't that also
No. I mean, the earliest forms are not, Farmer John's barley is better than Farmer Fred's. It's they owe the headman X amount of barley, or the god or goddess make them have boils.
I don't mean it that way. I mean, isn't there some gene or something aspect to our wiring also that requires us to account for our presence? In other words, to say we're here as an individual and here's why that matters. I mean, accounting in that way.
Well, that's the artistic impulse. And oddly enough, the artistic impulse arises in hominins well before the urge to count anything does, or to keep account of anything does. The best we can figure, and we've got no hard answers on it because they didn't write, something like that is going on in the caves in Europe.
I was going to mention those, the cave paintings in France.
And at roughly the same time, you've got the development of art in the form of figurines. Whether these were votive or meant to be manifestations of the divine, we don't know. But pre-agricultural societies did a lot of brilliant shit. And one of the things that we have to take note of is that in the grand scheme of things, we were much more successful as a species before we went agricultural. Because while agriculture did allow for massive population explosions, that's a blessing and a curse. But we were very good at being hunter-gatherers for damn near 100,000 years, and here we are with sedentary society having arisen 7,000-8,000 years ago, and we're on the verge of self-extinction. That would point to the idea that one method was more successful than the other.
So we need to go back on the farm and work in small units as opposed
No. The farm is the problem.
Oh. So what you're saying is if an anthropologist or somebody, a social scientist, were to look at the state of things today, what he or she would find are an out of shape, overweight, dull-witted, for the most part, glob of people who are not necessarily force-fed, but by force of habit, are everything that they know they're getting from particular channels on television, and they're sitting in their Barco lounger every night with their arms defiantly crossed, telling the TV to do me, not in a sexual sense, but in a sense of entertain me, divert me, distract me. do anything to keep me from contemplating these types of things that we're talking about. Isn't that part of the problem also? I mean...
Yeah, kind of. I mean, look...
I bet you're sorry you picked up on my call today, because I wasn't
I love this stuff.
I really wasn't going this
look
way.
Look, for instance, at the collapse of Mayan high culture. Now, this is that they had mathematical understandings that Europe would not come around to for ages.
Timekeeping in the sense of calendars, God knows they knew that.
Deep precision. And yet, at the same time, they deforested themselves. And, I mean, we're talking about massive cities of hundreds of, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people.
Of which there are not any easily discerned traces today. I mean, they're there.
No, there's plenty of traces.
No, but what I mean is, you don't just stumble over them. You've got to dig to find them.
No.
Really?
Especially okay. with the advances that have been made recently in LIDAR. We're finding out that southern Mexico into what we call Central America is just filthy with these places.
What is LIDAR? I don't know what that is. Is it like a form of radar?
Yeah, it's a ground penetrating. Detection system.
Okay, yeah, okay, and I have heard of that then. I just didn't know the name. But no, what I'm saying, when I say not easily, no traces that are easily found, prior to these developments in technology to find them, you might go centuries without realizing that something is nearby or underfoot.
Well, it depends on who you are.
Well, yeah,
the locals knew.
Yeah,
but they were careful about who they told.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Some of these cities, Palenque, Machu Picchu, it went undiscovered for years, but it's only undiscovered by white people. But what I'm getting at is, they had these magnificent civilizations. They deforested themselves. The rains and the erosion came along, and they deforested themselves so that they could burn limestone so that they could paint their pyramids white and then paint pretty pictures on them of snakes and birds and fish and shit like that, and gods. And eventually, it wasn't worth it anymore, and the people who were actually carrying those cultures on their backs walked the hell away. Because the cities had become unsustainable. And their descendants live in Guatemala and Honduras and Belize and Mexico to this day. You know, that's why I was talking when one of the little children died in one of our concentration camps. They had vaccinations down there. But they died when they got here because, as is so often the case, they came in contact with white folks, and we are some disease-bearing son motherfuckers, okay?
Yeah.
And they got the flu, and dead. And it's surprising to me. I try to keep up with it, but the mumps outbreak in the concentration camps. 900 people.
Yeah.
How's that not leading newscasts?
Well, and see, that opens a whole different.
But to go back to your premise, they walked away because it didn't work anymore, and it was the only way they could continue to survive. Now, if you go into Mesoamerican archaeology, you'll find that the Mayan civilization is it's pre-classic and classic and post-classic. I mean, it all didn't happen at once.
Yeah.
But it damn sure did happen. And eventually, the jungle came back, and the jungle swallowed up the cities. And it's sort of a living version of that poem Ozymandias.
Yeah.
look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Yeah. That was meant to be an intimidating statement, but it's really more of a cautionary thing about saying, yeah, I thought I was some shit. Turns out I wasn't.
And did I understand you correctly or misunderstand you? In the Mayan situation, the echelon of people who were making the choice to deforestation upon themselves to get the limestone to make the paint to put on the pyramid so they'd have a nice canvas, so to speak, to put pictures of their gods, could they be the governmental and or religious honchos of the time?
They were the priestly and the ruling class.
So that should be a cautionary tale in its own right.
And the ruling class, you know, the ruling class really didn't do anything. They were liable to be, you know, murdered by a neighboring chieftain or something in war. But for the most part, they sat around and ordered pyramids to be built. And every now and then, if things were looking a little rough, in order to propitiate the deities, they would drag. This is gross. Let's see. This is dinner in the Pacific time zone. They would drag a string of thorns through their tongue.
Oh, Jesus.
And through their lip. And the blood would be caught on, like, bark paper. And then the bark paper would be burnt as a sacrifice to the god.
Now,
that's about as bad as life got, apart from, you know, getting killed by one of your rival kings.
Well, here's the deal. Wouldn't it stand to reason that if Trump would have his ink be obtained that way, that we'd have damn few executive orders, take away the Sharpie and give him a string of thorns?
Well, but there's a larger, I mean, there's a larger point to all of this, and that is, as with today, you've got a ruling class and a priestly class that is running the show, and they are absolutely, they come to nothing without the willing participation of a whole lot of people busting their ass and not getting much in the bargain. You follow?
Yeah, and are they doing it willingly, blindly, or a combination of the two?
Well, look at your countrymen. You know, this all ties together with my questions about, you know, if you let's say you start working a job at 18. Well, why do you have to work? Why do you have to sacrifice the best years of your life to some corporate entity in order to be able to get a shitty little pension at 67 or 70? You follow?
Yeah.
What? Well, and that's the philosophical question that I keep asking. How much of a duty does an American citizen owe, or for that matter, a world citizen? How much does anybody on planet Earth owe to our corporate overlords for the privilege of serving them? Life is fucking short, okay? Cokie Roberts died today. I thought she was 152, but it turns out she was only 75. Rick Ocasek died again.
Yeah, 74.
74. Life is short. And who's the, I forget, was it David Hume? Probably not. Life is nasty, brutish, and short.
Yeah, I know the quote, but I forget who said it.
Or most men lead lives of quiet desperation. I think quiet desperation. One of those is Thoreau, pretty sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm the exception to that. I do what's known as noisy desperation. Because once I latched on to where, you know, what the deal is, I certainly am not going to go down silently. I want to, if I'm going down, baby, I want to make as much fucking noise about it as I possibly can and clue other people in to the situation, because maybe there's a chance that something can be changed by putting up a fuss.
But it's going to have to be massive and structural and systemic. For instance, Marx did not have the exact, we didn't know then what had happened to Mayan culture. What happens to his theories about capitalism and collapse if Marx knows about if Marx knows about what happened to the Mayans? Because you can't describe that as capitalist, but it sure as fuck collapsed according to according to Marxist principles. You can't get much more Marxist than the way the Mayan culture collapsed. And, you know, there are aspects of it that were climatologic. And so, lo and behold, is it inevitable? I mean, because Marx says it is. Marx says capitalism will kill itself. But we also found out that the Leninist-Stalinist version of Marxism was no more sustainable. So there's an urgency as we stand on the brink here to figure it out. And some of those things will not fit neatly into anybody's pre-existing paradigms. Well, you know, when we talk about homelessness in California, for instance.
Yeah.
Shit, I'd be homeless in California. There's no way. I mean, my crappy little house here is probably a goddamn million-dollar house in California if you just somehow pick it up and spirit it there. I couldn't live there.
Well, all joking aside, I have been homeless in California. Now, granted, it hasn't been recently. We're talking more than 15 years ago. But I went through a stretch where all kinds of things converged, where the sum total of the equation was, you can't live anywhere. You've got to just show up where you can and tough it out for as long as you can until things begin to turn around. And I was able to put everything into storage. I mean, by everything, there wasn't a lot. But my worldly goods, for the most part, got put into storage. I had a car at the time, and I had Punky the Cockatiel and Nietzsche the Calico Cat. And for the better part of a month, it was around this time of year, too. Maybe that's why I go into an annual funk toward the end of September for about a month. But we toughed it out and did as best we could until, you know, an opportunity presented itself for us to be somewhere. But that didn't work out, and we landed another place, which was good for 5 years worth of shelter. And what I'm saying is, more people than probably realize in this country, not just in California, but there are more people walking around in this country today who are one dire circumstance away from utter calamity, you know, and that should do two things. That should terrify you on one level, but it should also piss you the hell off that we live in a society, supposedly the home of the free, the land of the free, and the home of the whopper. Okay, that circumstances have been orchestrated in such a way that type of statistic is a reality. And if you people, and I know when I say you people, I don't mean the Horn family, because by their nature, the Horn family is not those people. We're just basically trying to get the word out amongst ourselves so we can go forth and do something to help forestall the inevitable. But if the people who are voting for Trump and his enablers and apologists do not grasp that they are one momentous calamity away, or even a minor or medium calamity away from being right where I was over 15 years ago for a month with a cat and a bird in a goddamn car, you know, fending off the prevailing forces around me, if they don't grasp that the same goddamn thing can happen to them, in a heartbeat that they're not living in the real world. And it ain't Trump and his cohorts and apologists and enablers who are going to help you or create a future that doesn't work for you in that way. They're not the answer. I used to go round and round with people I knew in 2016, the run-up to the election, who thought that Trump was the answer. And my response was, God damn it, if you think that this asshat, this clown, this manifest lunatic is the answer, then you didn't understand the question. You know, and you get this slack-jawed look back from them or some goddamn prepackaged talking point from them, and you may as well just walk away because they don't get it. They don't have the capacity to get it. And they blame it on everything. You were talking about something that triggered something in my head to mention. Trump is a representation of a fight that's been going on culturally for the better part of 50 years, maybe a little longer than 50 years, if you go back to the Beat Generation of the 50s, Ginsburg and Burroughs and Couric and all that crew. But it's been going on at least most of my lifetime, where you've got one group of people who think that everything is just tickety-boo the way that it is, and we need more of the same along those lines. And you've got another group of people whose mindset is the mirror opposite of that, where they're saying, wait a minute, you don't have to be an organization person, an organization man, you or woman in the gray suit, punching the clock and doing this meaningless thing in some ivory tower somewhere or breaking your fucking back under the August sun, you know, doing manual labor or whatever. You don't have to do that. There's a better way to go. And this cultural battle on some level has been going on for most of my lifetime, where people are just not buying in to the norms, for lack of a better term. And in a real way, Trump is a representation of that other side, that non-hippie side, if you will, that non-beat side, if you will, that non-free thinker side, if you will. And I would like to think that they are the last battalion of representatives of that generation, I mean literal representatives of that generation, who are this will be their last or next to the last battle, because they're dying off, and coming up behind them are younger people and more open-minded people who don't buy into their representations of how life ought to be. Hell, we're already seeing it and we've been seeing it in Europe. I mean, until some of these more right-wing politicians have been put in, that British asshat, Boris Johnson, I mean, where the fuck did he come from? I would like to think that there is some kind of hope. And I know that
I think we're talking about, at least in the corporate ruling class and the governmental class, is a certain form of nihilism. They know. I saw mention of Inhofe from Oklahoma.
Oh God, who said
something like, "I used to. I realized climate change was real until I realized how much it was going to cost me." I'm paraphrasing.
Which is typical of him, isn't it? I mean, I was in Oklahoma for a while.
But what I want to turn us towards, Scott, is an attempt to understand the gravity of the problem. And when I say these people are nihilistic, they know how bad it is, and they know how bad it's going to get, and all they want to do is get their hands on as much money and power as they can, because they think that can protect them against what's coming. And the fact of the matter is, we know that the richer you are, the longer you live, for the most part, statistically. The wealthier you are, the healthier you are, for the most part, statistically. So there's some, you know, there's some validity in their assumption. But they're willing to kill the rest of us to have it. And so the real gravity of the problem, I mean, it shit's already hitting the fan. It's going to hit it even harder, and the fan's just going to keep spinning, and the shit's going to keep flying here very, very soon. That's why I'm saying the United States of January 20th, 2025 is going to be something approaching unrecognizable, and we only get more unrecognizable from there. We cannot afford, and I mean that from a dollars and cents standpoint, we cannot afford to burn another goddamn lump of coal. We can't afford to burn the coal we were burning 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. It was a disaster for humanity and has been an ongoing disaster from the moment that it's dug out of the rock wall or gouged out of the ground to the moment that it's burned to the moment that we breathe its after effects. It has been a disaster for humanity, but of course the coal people say, well, it enabled the Industrial Revolution. And then they look at you like a cow looking at a new gate when you say to them, and what is it that makes you think that was a good thing? Because countless hundreds of thousands, millions of people were sacrificed on the altar of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, that's the dominionist, Calvinistic mindset in operation, Bob. And that is
it's also the capitalist mindset.
Well, that too. That too, because they all go hand in hand. Okay, the better you do, the more God loves you. Well, I am a stand for the notion that mindset, despite what appearances might tell us, is not the prevailing one. It may be the one that is currently in charge or in vogue, but there are more of us than there are of them.
And we don't organize.
Well, and we need, this is where I'm going with it. We need to organize. We need to really be clear what the stakes are, okay? Our very lives and futures will depend on what we do or don't do.
Well, you know, say what you will about the Bolsheviks, you'll notice that Russia does not have a Romanov problem.
Well, there you go, okay?
And for the most part, the French don't have a bourbon problem.
No, they don't, except maybe getting it, because you can only get bourbon in isn't
no,
bourbon it, one of those?
No, I'm talking about the French Royal Family.
No, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. But what I'm saying is, the game is not over. We may be in the latter part of the third quarter, to use a football analogy. Okay, and there are points on the board for both sides, but this game certainly isn't over. And we've got to start behaving as if there's something that can still be done. Because I think that we may not get nirvana or perfection or everything that we want, but there's a cultural change in the wind, and I really, at least electorally, 2018 should have been a hint as to how things are unfolding.
Well, the Republican exodus points toward the notion that the Republicans don't think they've got a snowball's chance in hell of taking back the House in 2020. Mitch McConnell's already mumbling about how we're going to have to preserve the filibuster. Because otherwise, I can't keep fucking America. If I don't have the majority to fuck it with, I can fuck America like I did when I was leading the minority. As long as we got the filibuster and a droopy dish rag like Harry Reid, and it don't get no droopier than Chuck Schumer. So there's a certain sense that there's handwriting on the wall, but I want to go back to something way at the beginning of the conversation, Scott. And I just have to. I say it a lot, and I just want to keep driving the point home. Trump is not the disease. Trump is a particularly virulent symptom of a disease. Yeah. The disease is Republicanism. Yeah, I said it. Gosh, if there were a lot more members of this community, there'd be a headline to it tomorrow. Liberal talker that says Republicans are a disease. Yes! And history fucking supports my position.
Yeah.
Trump didn't invent supply-side economics and trickling down and no. Trump didn't say we need to starve the government until it's weak enough to drown in a bathtub. He can't think that complexly. He is the natural evolution, because evolution is real, he is the natural evolution of the Republican Party. Like I said the other night, it goes from Goldwater to Reagan to Dan Quayle to W to Sarah Palin to what we got now. And that is a steady downward slope.
With an electorate to match.
With an electorate that runs on the power of grievance.
And that's really no way to proceed in life. Yeah, I understand grievance, but what they're up to, they're not bringing problems to the fore in order to address them, work together, and resolve them. They're just throwing shit in people's way. It's called obstructionism. It's called, well, whatever it's called. It's called, bullshitting people who are capable of being deluded so that you can continue to delude them, okay? But what I'm saying is I think we're going to turn a corner relatively soon if we behave correctly and responsibly, because in a way it's good that Trump is there because of how inept he is, but his enablers and cohorts and behind the scenes people and apologists, they are not inept. They are able, to wield a good fuck stick, if you will, okay, in the spokes of people's lives. I guess I mixed my metaphors there. But anyway, I hope Todd is listening.
He was earlier.
Okay, I sent it to you yesterday, but I had to go away, and I don't know if you mentioned my email to him. He mentioned a documentary series or whatever called Pandora's Box that he enjoyed seeing.
Yes.
The same guy that produced that, and I haven't seen it. I am going to watch it, though. But the same guy who produced that, Pandora's Box, a couple of years back did The Century of Self, or The Century of the Self, and The Power of Nightmares, which are both rather good. They're old enough to be kind of dated in terms of the things that they talk about, in terms of personalities and people in power and stuff going on culturally, but they're still relevant. And I would commend them both to Todd and anybody else who wants to watch them. And the other thing real quick, cause I'm going to go here in a minute, but I recorded a thing off of HBO last night, a movie from a couple of years ago, called Manhattan Night. And the only person in it that I can remember the name was Adrian Brody, I believe his name is. And it's a thriller. It's a mystery. It's got twists and turns that would do Hitchcock proud. And it's on HBO. You can find it on the schedule or on HBO Go to watch it on demand. Manhattan Night. It's not a great film, but it's a very watchable film. And it does tend to drag you in. Because just when you think you know what the hell's going on, there are twists and turns. And it even, one of the characters, without giving it away, is a Rupert Murdoch type of media mogul. And it's about a journalist. And it's about a suspicious death. Manhattan Night. It really is pretty good. Its feel is very Hitchcockian, if you will, since old Alfred, Sir Alfred, isn't around to make movies anymore. And I think it was made in 2016. So if you've got HBO or can find it, Manhattan Night, it will be about 2 hours well spent in terms of an entertaining flick. So, well, Bob, as always, I come in here and I work my grubby little finger in the program, and I raise more questions than we answer. But it's not my motive to mess people up or piss them off.
Oh no! I don't think that was the case at all. This was actually a fairly deep and, at least for me, intellectually stimulating conversation.
Well, and it's something worth having, because the more understanding you have of a situation and understand its history and roots and causes and what drives people and how they're, what is the nature of their wiring, that does give us insights and assistance in it's almost serves as a "you are here" thing, like the sign at the mall, because you've got to have a sense of your own history as a human being to get a sense of where you are now, to get a sense of what might be ahead and what you can do about it. I mean, that's pretty clear, isn't it? I mean,
one would it's "you are here" versus there was a sort of Buddhist-ish, Zen-ish book from back in the 60s called...
Be Here Now?
Be Here Now, precisely.
Yeah. Who did that? Was that Ram Dass?
Oh, I can't remember right off the top of my head.
I'm pretty sure it was. There's a pretty good documentary about him on, and he's still with us. He's hanging on. He's not doing well, but he's hanging on, last I heard. It's either on Netflix or Amazon Prime. And just look for Ram Dass, R-A-M-D-A-S-S, on your Netflix search bar or your Amazon Prime search bar. And I think it's still up there. It was at least a month or so ago. Rather insightful fellow. I don't know that he has all of the answers, but he sure as hell poses the fucking question. And I know that's frustrating for people, because people don't like questions. They only like answers. Okay? But that's one thing I've come to appreciate about you and the Horn family. We can dance with the answers, and we can dance with the questions.
Well, the one thing I was surprised you did not bring up. The passing of Cokie Roberts, who of course was the daughter of Hale Boggs.
Well, you know, I thought about it, but I beat that horse enough.
Well, I think he's a particularly interesting horse, insofar as he represented a sort of. There was a transition along the way for him, because he starts out as he's a Southern Democrat. He gets his start opposing Huey Long's machine. When Brown versus Board of Education comes along, of course, he's a dedicated segregationist. racist as hell. But then he supports the Voting Rights Act. And along the way, of course, he was the youngest member of the Warren Commission.
Well, okay, let's go there. Let's go there.
And as the youngest member of the Warren Commission, he questioned and did not agree with the famous single bullet theory. I find his life a lot more fascinating than that of his daughter who passed away today.
Well, and see, that's not the only interesting thing about Congressman Hale Boggs. Now, you also know, see, the Warren Commission was issued around this time of year in 1964, I believe it was September 21st. Okay, and he was one of the people chosen by Johnson, Lyndon Johnson, to give us an official story, an official answer as to the circumstances surrounding the demise of our late and esteemed President John F. Kennedy on the streets of Dallas. Okay, and what they came up with was 3 shots, 1 miss, 2 hits, 1 dead. Okay? But in order to account for that, they had to have what became known as the single bullet, or as I prefer, the magic bullet theory.
Right.
That a single bullet basically did all of the non-fatal damage to both Kennedy and Connally. Okay? But it for a number of reasons I won't go into, it was an impossibility. It defied physics. It defied...
Yeah, nobody who understands ballistics, even vaguely, buys into the magic bullet theory.
Well, it defied physics. It defied ballistics. It defied the conditions present on that day.
Logic,
defied,
reality, common sense.
It defied the capability of the gunman, alleged gunman, I should say. It defied even the capability of a 20-year-old surplus Italian carbine, bolt-action rifle that basically was derided during World War II when it was being used.
It also defied the evidence available at the time.
Yeah, yeah. But here's the deal. Congressman Boggs didn't buy into it, whereas the other, I think there was one other member of the commission, I want to say it was John Sherman Cooper, who I believe was from Kentucky, a senator from Kentucky, who also didn't buy into it. I could be wrong, but I think he was the other person who didn't buy into it. But a couple of years later, so we're talking about Warren Commission issued in 64. A couple of years later, about 70 or 71, maybe it was 72, Congressman Boggs was on a trip to Alaska.
Yes.
To support a person named Begich, who was running for, I think, the House of Representatives from Alaska. And they were traveling, barnstorming from place to place in an airplane.
Well, you're about I know where you're going, but you're about to blow past a couple of interesting little points.
Okay, go ahead.
On the floor of the House in April 1971, he lambasted J. Edgar Hoover and the entire FBI.
Ah, yes.
In a recorded phone call with Nixon and Gerald Ford, also April 1971, Nixon says, "I can no longer take counsel from Boggs as a senior member of Congress."
And then
he asks Gerald Ford to make an alternative to Boggs part of the House delegation. Ford, being slimy and complicit, said, "Well, Mr. President, I think he's probably on pills and booze," which, of course, is exactly what Nixon was on.
Yeah. Oh, and it should be mentioned that Gerald Ford also sat on the Warren Commission.
Yes.
And was a lone nutter. He even wrote a book called Portrait of an Assassin, or Ghost wrote a book, had a book ghost written for him. But anyway, proceed.
And then, also in April 1971, he says the following. Boggs does. He despises Hoover, who was despicable. Over the post-war years, we have granted to the elite and secret police within our system vast new powers over the lives and liberties of the people. At the request of the trusted and respected heads of those forces, and their appeal to the necessities of national security, we have exempted those grants of power from due accounting and strict surveillance.
Powerful stuff, Bob.
Yeah, it is. Remember that John Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs, said he would like to, what did he say? He'd like to break the CIA into a million pieces?
A thousand, but same concept.
And Harry Truman authored an op-ed saying that the CIA should be disbanded. And then, of course, Kennedy gets all dead.
In October of 63... about a month before Kennedy was shot and killed on the streets of Dallas. And I can't remember the writer, but it was a writer for the New York Times, wrote a piece indicating that if there was a coup in the United States, an overthrow of power, the CIA would likely be the people behind it, or elements of the CIA would be behind it. And like a month later, a shift in power occurred. And it was horrible and violent, if you've seen the Zapruder film.
Well,
and we were given a bullshit explanation less than a year later. Okay? But, yeah, I mean, in those days, it didn't pay you to question the FBI.
No, and so what happens to Hale Boggs is that, now, remember, this wasn't just some backbencher. He was the House Majority Leader.
Yeah.
And Nick Begich of Alaska had opposed him and voted against him for that position, but Hale Boggs went and campaigned for him just the same, and that's what they were doing in Alaska. It's worth remembering that about a month before, a new law had gone into effect requiring an emergency transponder on every aircraft. Yet, for some reason or another, the plane that Boggs and Begich were in didn't have it, and the pilot was allowed, by, I think, some sort of grandfather rule, to have one, a personal one, on his person. Well, the plane went down. It was never found. And later on, his personal transponder was found on a plane in Anchorage.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
They searched for 39 days. There was not even a trace of the aircraft ever found.
Wow. I had forgotten all about his rather blistering comments about the FBI and Hoover and that crew. Jesus.
And so, there's more than enough. There have been a number of speculative theories about the whys and wherefores of his disappearance. I mean, of course, little Cessna aircraft do just go down. It does happen. But when someone who has said the things he had said goes all missing without a trace, nor Boggs, the pilot, nobody.
That recorded conversation between Nixon and Jerry Ford added into the equation. And given what we know about Nixon, certainly, and Jerry Ford to a different extent, I mean, he was... A lot of people liked him because, I guess, compared to Nixon, anybody would look like a decent alternative. But I think history will show that Jerry was not as pure, anywhere near as pure, as people thought he was, at least in the wake of Nixon.
Well, no, this is a guy who was the Republicans are apoplectic that anyone would dare suggest that we have impeachment hearings for a guy who is a credibly accused sexual predator and sits on the Supreme Court. They forget, however, that Jerry Ford, as a Republican member of the House, howled from the rooftops for the impeachment of Earl Warren, not because Earl Warren had put his penis in a woman's hand or tried to rape a teenager at a party, but because Earl Warren was issuing rulings that authoritarian Jerry Ford didn't like.
Yeah. Well, in various parts in the Midwest and South, in the bumper stickers,
impeach Earl Warren.
Oh, bumper stickers, billboards.
Yep.
I never saw one, but I've seen photos of them, and I've certainly heard tell of them.
See, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes real good sometimes.
Got that right.
And the first impeachment of a Supreme Court justice, again, I mentioned that last night, was because of the politics of his rulings, not because he was violating the law. They just didn't like
it. Was that a long while ago? Because I remember Abe Fortas, one of...
That impeachment was presided over by Aaron Burr.
Okay, so that was back in the old days.
As Vice President of the United States and President of the Senate.
Well, actually, and I'm not up on my procedure, but actually, that's the only remedy for a federal judge from the Supremes on down.
Yeah.
In terms of if something comes up that should have been considered in the, you know, nominating and hearing process of the procedure, then that's the only remedy that's afforded.
Yeah, that's all you got, because, as I mentioned last night, the commission that oversees the ethics of federal judges, their jurisdiction ends at the Circuit Court of Appeals. They cannot say boo to a member of the Supreme Court. And that's why you've got Clarence Slappy Thomas and Brett Kavanaugh on there.
Well, and see, that's another thing that we don't talk about near enough with Trump. If that fool gets elected in 2020, God forbid, if there is a God listening who's into such forbidding, you know that poor Justice Ginsburg is getting on and has had health problems. Justice Breyer is no spring chicken. What's her name? Sotomayor and the other younger justice, they're probably okay. But the rest of the Democrats on the Supreme Court are getting on in years. And that it's not a cushy job. It's not like digging ditches. But there is a certain toll that it takes on you.
And so once again, we find ourselves back contemplating the America that we will have if Donald Trump is not gone on January the 20th, 2021.
Yeah. It's like I keep saying, Bob, that imagine a poker table with green felt top and a stack of chips in the center. And somebody in 2020 is going to grab those chips. And it had better be our side. We had better make the much-needed overdue course correction that I go on about. And it all comes down to my mantra. Behave in a manner that's consistent with creating a future that works positively and appropriately for us all. And you can't go wrong in following that mantra. And the only way you can go wrong with it is to ignore it and not to do it, not to live it out. So
true enough. Well, let's get out of here, Scott. You have yourself a good evening, and I'm going to wrap things up.
There endeth the lesson.
Indeed.
I appreciate it, Bob, and I appreciate the Horn family. Oh, and I'm glad that you like the pictures of Rick and Joe.
I love those.
Tom Ross.
And hey, by the way,
yeah.
During our conversation, you know, your bad coffee has become legendary.
Oh, I know.
And a kind, sweet, and generous member of the community has reached out and said, I'd like to send Scott a bag of the River Moon coffee that who advertises on Mike Malloy's program. And I said, I don't think you've even got a coffee pot.
No, I haven't had one for a few years.
Well, this sweet, kind, and generous person said, that can be included.
Oh, no.
So if you would like, email me your mailing address.
Okay.
And I think there will be a coffee pot and a big bag of really good coffee coming your way.
Well, bless you, kind anonymous donor. I had not expected any largesse along those lines, but I'm not going to look a gift bag of coffee and coffee pot in the mouth. So yes, Bob, I will follow up and send you all the particulars.
I mean, because this is what the community does for each other. This is what makes it all so special.
I appreciate that. And what's the coffee called?
River Moon.
River Moon.
A fellow by the name of Jeff, who was at the Malloy Mountain Getaway this past June, roasts it and sells it. And he advertises on Malloy's program. And if you, and this is just free, this is unpaid product placement. You can go to just look up River Moon Coffee, and it's a bag of the specially blended and roasted for Malloy Truth Seekers, Keep It Lit Blend.
Okay, I'll look that up, and then I'll send you the particulars on getting it to me. That's a very pleasant surprise, Bob. I appreciate that. See, that's yet another reason why this program needs to remain on the air. Not only do we talk about meaningful stuff and look at questions and get solutions, and we yuck it up sometimes, but out of the blue, you can have little things like this occur that if someone had tugged your sleeve first thing in the morning and said, what's something that will happen today that you didn't expect? If you had given me 2 days to come up with an answer, I would not have guessed that.
No, so that it would happen. I'm pretty certain. I feel really comfortable saying that this is the only radio program in the United States. There's a billion of them now. That combined the reasons for the development of cuneiform, the comparison between hunter-gatherer and sedentary agricultural societies, and the collapse of Mayan civilization in one radio conversation. We're it. You don't get that anywhere else.
With a side trip of the modern history of American politics vis-a-vis Hale Boggs.
Yeah.
You know, where else does this occur? It doesn't. This is it.
And I feel pretty good about that. I mean, we're little. We could grow a lot bigger if folks wanted it to. And we could make the community even larger still. But we do things here, and again, it's because we are not dependent upon making sure that we don't step on the toes of people who make bombs and missiles in the course of the stories we cover here. We're free to go where our minds take us.
Mm-hmm. And boy, do we get taken to places.
I'm fascinated with it.
Well, that's the nature of conversation. If you've got people really intent upon opening new doors and vistas for folks, for themselves, I get as much out of asking the questions as I do some of the responses that you come up with. This show has served me well in terms of shit that I've learned that I don't know that I would ever know had I not been exposed to the horn community and the conversation that goes on here. And there's never an end to it. Every new conversation usually has some reference to one that happened last week or even last year. You know?
Right.
And that's as it should be, I think. You know? So
There are still some that stick out in my mind, and I wish I could find them. There was a conversation Reverbo and I had years ago now that encompassed it. It was basically the history of Western civilization in an hour. And I would give anything to know when that happened. Yeah, because that was just, I mean, and it all had to do with the Afghanistan war, and it just turned into a sort of grand theory of everything.
Is there is an archives for the Horn shows going back a ways, isn't there?
It goes all the way back to October 24th, 2005. Maybe even further.
Where would one find that? Over
at White Rose. WhiteRoseSociety.org, and then you've got to drill down into, you got to go into the deep archives.
Okay.
Because I'm not. Because
I was sitting here the other, and I know we both hate long goodbyes, but I was sitting here the other day trying
we'll
to
always
think.
Have Paris.
Yeah. I was sitting here the other day trying to figure out how long I've been listening to this program. And I guess the only way to do it is to go back in my emails, because the very first email I sent you, as I recall, was shortly after I started listening, and it was about my encounter in high school, like bringing a Nazi in for show and tell.
Yeah, Nazi show and tell. I remember that.
Yeah, okay. All right, so I'll look for that email and figure out how long I've been listening, because it certainly does bring something special, California time, to a weekday afternoon. To know that I can flip a switch or two and hear cogent news, okay? Hear news that matters to me, okay?
Man, this is almost like a public radio pitch.
Well, no, I'm serious, Bob. News that matters to me, current events, insights and analysis that you're not going to get anywhere else. So you've got that on one end of the spectrum. But on the other end of the spectrum, you've got mass silliness some days. And then midway on the spectrum, you've got conversations along the lines of what we've been doing today, which, as you say, accurately, where else are you going to hear this particular sort of eclectic, stimulating, intelligent, entertaining, compelling conversation? There ain't no other place. This is it.
That anybody can participate in who wants to.
Yeah.
And that's the key to it.
It's a good time to be alive, I think, despite the madness.
And you've set it all up, so let me finish and say, tonight was a goose egg. We got an ugly bunch of bills to pay. And to finish out the month, and this does not bode well for finishing fundraising so we can have fundraising free radio come Tuesday or maybe even Monday. But we're at minus 390. Prayer meeting Wednesday, the deacons will be passing the plate for minus 590. Ouch. But anyway, Scott, thank you for the kind words. Lee in New York gets the last word. I will always remember Gerald Ford as a congressman who did not sponsor or co-sponsor any significant legislation over the course of his entire legislative career. That's Jerry Ford.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, Scott, have a good night, my friend.
All right, take care, Bob.
All right, later.
See ya.
And so we come to the end of Trumptanic Tuesday, and it has been epic. As they so often are. And thanks to all of you who keep the program going. Thank you so very kindly to our subscribers and to our ad hoc contributors who are partial sponsors of the entire effort. Thank you to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program, however you so do and whenever you so do. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks earlier in the evening to Sparky. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, head on.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org, wherein reside the deep archives of the Horn. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.